From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. The creation of art has its foundation in individual expression. While the prison system is based on regimentation and the suppression of the individual. So how is it possible, then, for incarcerated people to create art? Yet they do, in spite of the constraints and limitations. And that is the subject of Dr. Nicole Fleetwood's work. Dr. Fleetwood is an art historian and curator. She explores how the art of incarcerated people is essential to our understanding of mass incarceration and the people it affects. And it's for this work that she's been named a 2021 MacArthur Fellow. A professor of media, culture, and communication at NYU, she's the author of the award-winning book, Marking Time, Art in the Age of Mass Incarceration, and curator of the acclaimed accompanying museum exhibit, also called Marking Time. In both the exhibit and the book, Dr. Fleetwood uncovers the cultural, personal, social, and aesthetic significance of incarcerated people's art. I had the good fortune to speak with her last December. Here's our conversation. Well, first of all, Dr. Fleetwood, thank you for joining me. I really appreciate it.
I'm so happy to be here. I wish we were in person, but...
I do too. But let's begin with this extraordinary project, both a book and an exhibit, Marking Time. How did this begin for you?
Wow. So it began as a very small and intimate project of grappling with how hyper-incarceration has impacted my family in Southwest Ohio. I grew up in a town called Hamilton, Ohio. It's in Butler County. It's in a really conservative part of Ohio. And we were raised in a small Black community there. And by the time I was a teenager in the mid to late 80s, I just witnessed the onslaught of aggressive punitive policing, the militarization of police forces, even in small communities like where I grew up. And, you know, just was astounded by the way that hyper-incarceration impacted especially young Black boys in my community. Many of my cousins ended up in prison. Many of them ended up arrested and then let go without charges. And some who ended up serving, you know, many decades in prison. And as I went on in school, you know, I was always a good student. And, you know, as I moved along with my education, I was always haunted by the way that prisons in the carceral state impacted other people in my community who didn't make it out. And so after I finished my first book, Troubling Vision, in 2010, I couldn't shake just these images of my incarcerated relatives that many of them would send from prison. And it was a project that I actually really resisted, and I felt guilty about resisting it, I have to say that. And so over the course of time, I started to just explore these really quiet images that are made inside prison visiting rooms when loved ones go to visit their incarcerated relatives, and in some occasions, incarcerated people, like for holidays, can pose in front of painted backdrops. The backdrops are also painted by incarcerated people. So it started with a couple dozen sets of images of loved ones and posing with loved ones during these visits. And from there, it has grown into a rather large-scale project that includes collaborations with dozens and dozens of artists, organizations, and activists across the country. It's a book, as you mentioned, called Marking Time, Art in the Age of Mass Incarceration. It's also a traveling exhibition that debuted at MoMA PS1 in September 2020 and just closed at the Abrams Ingalls Institute for the Visual Arts in Birmingham. And in the spring of 2022, it will be traveling to the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is literally 30 minutes away from where I grew up and where this project started.
When you wrote the book, did you envision an exhibition?
So to be honest, I did not know I was writing a book. I wrote an article about these pictures that I mentioned, these photos of my incarcerated relatives. And that was published in Public Culture. And I actually didn't know if I would have the strength, the wherewithal to continue this project because there was just so much grief that poured out as I was working on it and just, you know, longing for my family and just just a lot of pain and isolation and the stigmatization of being criminalized or having loved ones criminalized. So I didn't know it was going to be a book, let alone an exhibition. But as the project grew and more, and I met more and more artists, so the basis of the book is over 60 interviews with currently and formerly incarcerated artists. To be honest, I could have written two or three books based on like the wealth of materials that were shared with me. But as I, you know, gathered more and more materials and interviews, I realized, okay, this is longer than an article. This is a book. And it wasn't until the book was in the copy edit stage, and I was really so deeply moved that it was turning into a book, but I also felt like this can't just be a book. It has to be able to reach audiences that might not want to read an almost 300-page, fairly dense academic book published by Harvard University Press. And so then I began this journey of figuring out how to create an exhibition. And I had done some exhibitions before, I should say, like at Rutgers, and then collaborating with organizations like Mural Arts Philadelphia, also a place up in the Bronx where a multi-service center in the Bronx called the Andrew Friedman Home, where I had done an exhibition in 2017, and also collaborating with Aperture. But this felt like much larger scale. And it was also a bit like blind calling because I tried to create relationships with culture institutions in New York and their fortresses. They don't just, you know, read anybody's exhibition prospectus. So it was also figuring out how to navigate that entire world to get a yes.
How did you connect with imprisoned people? I mean, what was that process like, finding them and then looking at their art? How did you go about that?
So I started small with what I had and what I knew. And, you know, I told my cousins at some point, I said, you know, I want to do a book about art in prison. And my cousin Alan, who at the time was in prison, thankfully he's released now, he laughed and he said, how are you going to do that? He said, everyone in here considers themselves an artist. You know, it was this great insight for me around also like what people do when they're held captive. When everything that's familiar and they love is taken away from them, a lot of people turn to like their creativity as one site of autonomy or semi-autonomy, getting materials and getting resources to make art and also skill sets sometimes creates relationships of dependence and vulnerability. So Alan put me in touch with Dean Gillespie, who is an artist featured both in the book and exhibition, who made these gorgeous miniatures during his 20 years in prison. And they had been in prison together for like, I think their sentences overlapped for like 15 to 16 years, and they became great friends. And I was so curious about that relationship too, because Alan grew up in a small town, but fairly urban part of Ohio. And Dean is a white man from like a rural, very even more conservative part of Ohio. And I realized that art making in prison facilitated these relationships that crossed racial and ethnic boundaries, that cross other kind of boundaries that are really strictly reinforced in many prisons as a way of maintaining order and keeping division between imprisoned populations. So yeah, started small with the people I knew. And by 2014, I was able to fundraise. I was directing an institute called the Institute for Research on Women. And my colleague, Sarah and Tobias, and I fundraised to do this national conference. That was this one of the important seeds of this book. It was called Mark and Time, Prison Art and Activism. And we brought in over 110 people, many of them formerly incarcerated people. Some of them, you know, are people who had never been on a plane up until their release from prison. And so many of the voices that show up in the book and the artists who show up on the exhibition were people I met during that 2014 gathering.
Can you explain or share rather some of the constraints that people in prison have as they create art? I mean, what does it actually take for an artist to create and share work in prison?
So that was actually the question that drove this project. That question that, you know, was like, I was so curious about exactly that question, but I also had these ethical commitments. I'm an abolitionist. I believe that we need to come up with more humane, more caring, more transformative ways of dealing with law breaking, harm, and other kind of social and infringements. I think we should not be putting people in cages. So that I wanted that ethical commitment to run through, my love of my family to run through. But it's also like my own obsession around human creativity. I find human creativity to be more fascinating than almost anything on a planet. And I really wanted to know, how does human creativity thrive when one is held in punitive captivity, when one is held in a 6-foot by 9-foot cell, when one is, again, taken, removed from everything that's familiar to them, everything that everyone and everything they love, when so much of their sentence is about material constraint, about not having access to materials, about not having access to space, to teachers, to all kinds of resources that artists outside of prison, many of them take for granted, whether they have money or not. Still, they have a type of mobility to go around and even forage for materials. You know, all of that is up for grabs in prison.
Can I add one other one too, which is, I think prison is so much an attack on the senses, how loud it is and the way it's devoid of color and no sunlight. And then to actually be creating art at a, in a place like that is extraordinary.
Absolutely. And that, and I have to say that that sensory overstimulation or sensory deprivation, that both of those really just run throughout the project, so much so that there's one chapter in the book that's exclusively about making art in solitary confinement.
That was a tough chapter.
Yeah,
I just gotta say.
Oh my God. I'm not giggling because I think it's funny. It's more like release. I mean, it was a really hard chapter. It's removing people away from almost everything that makes them human. And it is a form of what Ruthie Wilson Gilmore says, a premature death. I mean, people who spend a long time in solitary confinement come out with often, you know, really intense long-term medical and psychological damage, and often cannot, you know, return to general population because they've been, what philosopher Lisa Gunther says, they've been unhinged from themselves. And people in solitary confinement also don't have access to programs that run for general population. They don't have informal art collectives to make art with. And so often they're really, their only relationship is with the self or with, or through some kind of correspondence course, like Billy Sell, who was in a correspondence course taught by the Prisoner Express, which is run out of Ithaca, New York. And there was a volunteer teacher, Tracy Ziegler, running a drawing class who would send Billy Sell drawing instructions. And he would draw and then mail these drawings back to her. So it was this, you know, this correspondence course that really sustained him. And he would write these, you know, very emotional letters about feeling inadequate, which is a common effect of solitary confinement. It's just really internalized a devaluing of self that the state has put upon them. And so these letters really document this. And as he struggles to make art. And he's someone who actually didn't survive solitary confinement. He was part of a hunger strike in California and was found unresponsive in his prison cell.
As I looked at the exhibition and read the book, the materials that incarcerated people use to make art and the way they repurpose things is, again, the innovation just knocks your socks off.
Right. So prison bed sheets are commonly used, like Jesse Crimes, who's become quite well known as an artist. He's been out of prison now for I think 6 or 7 years. And while he was in prison, he made this large scale mural that's, I think it was something like 15 feet by 40. And it's over 39 prison bed sheets. And it took him 3 years to make this. And so he was able to, through networks in prison, get these bed sheets, which that in itself is considered contraband. And it's an infringement of against prison rules to mark on state property. So he had to do this in stealth ways. And so once he'd have a bed sheet completed, he'd find a way to send it out of prison, and did this over 3 years and wasn't able to see the work in its completion until he was released from prison and found his space big enough. Gilberto Rivera, who's good friends with Jesse, they were in prison together, used his state-issued clothes for this really powerful mixed-media collage called An Institutional Nightmare. And I mentioned Dean Gillespie earlier. He would find items from trash that had been discarded. He'd also have friends help him, what he would say, quote, procure materials, which means to take materials without the permission of the state in the service of art making. And so many of his miniatures incorporate you know, wood blocks from the wood workshop or sewing pin needles that someone had sneaked out or, you know, other items that he was able to acquire. He has this one movie house that he created. It's a miniature of a movie house with these hundreds and hundreds of little bricks that he fabricated in his cell using dental compound that someone was able to sneak out of the medical office. So these are all just some examples of the type of innovation and experimentation that takes place in prison. And so much of it, especially in the visual arts, is incarcerated people experimenting with color because there's often very limited color palettes access that they have. So often they're using Kool-Aid or M&Ms or other kinds of materials that they can dissolve to create some type of hue. And that is definitely a way of refuting what you mentioned earlier, which is the very drab conditions under which people are incarcerated. What else came out in researching in terms of thinking about what type of art is made is like the predominance of portrait making in prisons. It's the most common form of art making. And it is very literally a resistance to state issue IDs like the mugshot and the prison ID card. A lot of incarcerated people don't have access to other images of themselves or very limited images of themselves. And so portrait making becomes this really important way of creating images that are much more about a type of elevation and veneration. And that's often about self-presentation, especially when incarcerated people are involved in self-portrait making.
Well, the cover of your book is Pyrrhic Defeat by Mark Lotney, and it's a series of portraits. And Pyrrhic Defeat also takes up an entire room of the exhibit. I would love to have you talk about this and why you chose it for the cover.
Yeah, happy to do that. And so Mark Lotney is currently incarcerated in Pennsylvania. We're hoping that he'll be released. He's up for parole at the beginning of 2022. And since 2014, he's been engaged in this very rigorous, expansive series called Pyrrhic Defeat, a visual study of mass incarceration. Though a series consists of portraits of other incarcerated people who are serving time with him. And so he asked fellow imprisoned people to sit for about 20 minutes. Most of these sketches are no longer than 20 minutes, but they're really detailed, expressive, evocative works. They're all 12 inches by 9 inches. At this point, I think he's up to about 750 of them. And for him, it's also really important that they be understood together as one work and shown together.
They're individually so striking, but the power of all of them is extraordinary.
So the power of all of them for him is really a way of visualizing the toll of mass incarceration from the site of captivity, from someone who's in prison reflecting on what mass incarceration looks like. I often also will use the word hyper-incarceration because it's not the mass incarceration of everyone. It's not spread evenly across this nation or a state, right? It's the hyper-incarceration of specific populations. And those populations almost are exclusively Black, Latinx, poor, white, indigenous people, gender nonconforming people, unhoused people, people with undiagnosed mental health issues. So it's like the most vulnerable populations being hyper-criminalized, hyper-punished, and hyper-sentenced.
Talk about, both in the exhibit and in your book, the community that's created around art. And we touched on that a bit in this conversation with your cousin Alan and with Dean Gillespie and also with the Fairton Collective. You mentioned Gilberto Rivera and Jesse Crimes, and the third leg of the Fairton Collective is Jared Owens, yeah. And they were all in prison together. Tell us just a little bit about how they came together.
So one of the most captivating things that I learned through this research is that in no way do I want to valorize or romanticize prisons, but they are these hubs of creativity. And there's a lot of informal art collectives, peer mentoring. There's some formal, you know, classes taking place through like the William James Association and other organizations that bring arts into prisons. But so much of what takes place is these informal networks of people coming together to make art and to really claim the time that they're being punished, what I call penal time, and turning it into something else. And the Ferretin Collective, consisting of Gilberto Rivera, Jesse Crimes, and Jared Owens, is a multiracial group that formed in a federal prison in New Jersey. They all were interested in art before they arrived at Ferretin. Jared had been there for many years before Gilberto and Jesse arrived, and he was trusted among the prison staff and was allowed to run this very small makeshift studio room where a few artists could come in and have a little bit of studio space. And he, Jesse, and Gilberto, very different personalities, very different styles of making art. They hit it off. You know, Jesse is white, Gilberto is Puerto Rican, and Jared is African American. And they just really committed to each other. It became a lifelong friendship. All three of them are out. They're all successful artists. But so much of the work they're doing now that's getting critical praise, the seed started when they were in Ferretin. And they would do these hours-long critique of each other's work. They would resource pool. They didn't have money to subscribe to all the art magazines. So one would, you know, subscribe to Art News, one to Art Forum, one to Art in America. And they would, you know, share the magazines with each other, share techniques. They would all get assignments to do research on a specific artist and to come back to the group and talk about that artist. And you see the power of that collective work in their contemporary success here in 2021.
Have the artists in the exhibit been able to see it at all? People who are still in prison, have you been able to videotape it and send it to them?
So a great question. And so, I mean, one of the things I want to say is that contact and communication with imprisoned people during COVID has become more difficult for everyone. Yeah. So a lot of the organizations that were running programs in prison still have not been able to go back in person. COVID has isolated imprisoned people even more. And with that said, anyone who's participating in Marking Time who's in prison, what we do is we print, you know, paper is still in some ways the easiest way of communicating with incarcerated people. So we've print out, you know, reviews, news highlights, images of artwork, so installation shots. In some of our online events, Zoom events, we've been able to facilitate conversations that include incarcerated people, often through a loved one or an organization that's able to accept the collect call. And then we're able to patch that in through Zoom, right? And so it's not like a perfect patch, but it's a way of at least getting those voices in conversation. That really is an ongoing process. And I want to say it's like constantly evolving. That's where I feel like creativity is really important, because the state's mandate is really to isolate incarcerated people and to keep them as separate from what's familiar to them as possible into the outside world. And so people on the ground who are really committed to, you know, undoing carcerality have to be creative about ways of being in conversation with imprisoned people. But what I want to say is that, you know, a couple of the artists in the exhibition are no longer alive, and that's Billy Sell. And then Ronnie Goodman, who was someone I had great conversations with, passed away during COVID on the streets of San Francisco.
His picture opens your book.
It opens the book, and it's such a wonderful, it's for me, that painting still teaches me. I go back to that painting every day because it's to me, it's like one of my greatest teachers about the stakes of making art under punitive captivity. And also how this is not an aspirational story. I mean, people do this to survive, but they're still living lives of vulnerability inside prison. And once released.
Do you mind just very briefly describing that painting?
Yeah, so the book opens with a painting, a self-portrait of Ronnie Goodman in the arts workshop space at San Quentin, where over the course of his almost 10 years there, he estimates that he made over 1,000 works. And it's a really quiet, contemplative painting of an artist at work. And so you see Ronnie studying one of his prints in this cavernous workshop space. It's like a two-story workshop space where light is pouring in and art is all over the wall. And then up above, you see a window where the prison guards can look down and not be seen. Visual signifiers that, oh, this is not just any art workshop space. This is taking place in a prison. You know, I was so captivated by this painting, but it took me years to be in touch with Ronnie because he was unhoused. And then when he and I were able to talk about it, it just blew my mind how he described the work and how he described his own practices of like planning for it, and how it was also a painting that's putting him in a tradition of artists at work who document themselves at work, but also he was memorializing the space that he never wanted to go back to. He also calls himself curating. He said, I was curating because he's like, these are not how the other paintings were hanging on the wall. And he's, you know, making multiple paintings in this self-portrait because he repaints all these artworks around him as part of the, you know, the larger environment that he's trying to document. So we really get this both interior and exterior sense of the stakes of art making in prison.
I love the light in it and the way he uses light. But what I find most interesting, it's both immersive and at the same time, we have some distance from it.
Yes, that's what, exactly. And that's why I say interior and exterior, right? Because you do have some access to like, this is a person in deep contemplation, but then you also get a sense of the environment around it.
Nicole, I know you have to go and you only have time for one more question. And I do want to talk about the MacArthur Award. First of all, congratulations on being named a MacArthur Fellow because of all of this wonderful work that you've done. And I'm wondering whether this gives you the opportunity to extend this project.
First of all, thank you. I'm still like, it's been a couple of months, but I'm still like, oh my goodness, I can't believe this happened. You know, it's a deep honor. And I have to say, part of what was so meaningful about receiving this is many of the artists in Marking Time, they put together this like little booklet of like art for me and just congratulating me. And then I got thousands of messages from like elementary school friends to other imprisoned people internationally. It was very, very powerful. And the show, as I said, the show is traveling. And so definitely the resources and support from the MacArthur will just help amplify and expand the tour of the exhibition. And we hope that it will tour for the next few years. I mean, you know, there are a lot of venues that are interested in it, and we're working out some of the logistics. I mentioned that in the spring, it's gonna go to the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. And then next fall, it's supposed to go to Brown University. And I'm working with a very small team. We're very hands-on, very small team. And we're also looking at how to just use the resources and the attention to just amplify support for the artists in the show, because many of them are doing well, but many of them are still struggling with some basic issues. Like I'm working with one person right now struggling with some very basic issues around housing because she has a felony conviction and a lot of places still discriminate. And so there's a lot to be done that's behind the scenes, behind, you know, the glorious art on the wall to just keep growing a community and, you know, supporting people in terms of like creating the kind of communities and society we all want to inhabit, where people are recognized, people are allowed access to some very basic things, and when people go wrong or do wrong, that there's a way of repairing and transforming harm and bringing people back into community.
Well, first of all, many congratulations on the book, on the exhibit. Many thanks for all the work you do. And of course, congratulations on the MacArthur. Thank you. And thank you for giving me your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your interest and for the great questions.
That was Dr. Nicole Fleetwood, a 2021 MacArthur Fellow. She's curator of the traveling exhibition Marking Time, Art in the Age of Mass Incarceration, and author of the book of the same name. You can find out more about both at markingtimeart.com, and you'll find a link to this in the show notes. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.